Unfortunately, Callum, I think your taste in dads is too good because John Aaron, I think, is a good guy. I think he's a good dad.
They warned me of this much. This is my fatal flaw.
Yeah, hubris. Okay.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Bite Marks, a podcast for gamers, by gamers, about politics, and sometimes about Game of Thrones. And guess who? You know what they've never asked about Game of Thrones? Who is the most okay dad? Like, not who's the best, not who's the worst, but who is directly in between them on the scale of dad? Who is the yardstick to which we measure all other fathers to? That's what we're going to find out today here, folks. But before we begin, let me give a quick mention of my wonderful co-host, Emilio.
Hey, everybody. It's me, Emilio. Pronouns he, him.
And our other wonderful guest, Hillary from Heels Alive.
Hi, Hillary. My pronouns are she, her.
And I'm Callum, and my pronouns are indecipherable. So, how we're going to do this is that we are each going to pitch a dad, and we're going to give a case as to why they're the most, like, mediocre, okay, mid-father in the entire series of Game of Thrones, A Song of Ice and Fire, House of the Dragon, and Fire and Blood. Now, the rules are as follows. You have to pitch someone who is either a father themselves or in a father figure role. They don't necessarily have to be a father in that they have kids, but they do have to be that sort of caretaker towards someone. The other rule is that they have to be mediocre. Not necessarily a mediocre person. We're not arguing about good people and bad people or whatever. We're arguing about they have to be mediocre at being a caretaker. Okay. So I think I'm going to start us off. Is that cool with everyone?
Yeah, but I would like to say that what the definition of mediocre actually is, that is actually also part of this conversation. You know, we're going to get into what exactly counts as mediocre for the perspective of fatherhood. But yeah, Callum, you're more than welcome to start.
Okay, let me specify just right off the bat. This is as a father figure, because this character is a father. But I'm arguing them in their role as father figure, and I'm probably going with the show version. John Aaron is the most yeah, he's the most mediocre dad. He's the most mediocre dad to Robert Baratheon and Ned Stark.
Okay. Run me through this exactly here.
There is a scene in the very first episode of season one in which Robert Baratheon talks about how good of a father, like, father figure John Aaron was, and how he kept trying to teach them good lessons. And then, like, Ned either gives him a look or go, like, scoffs or whatever, and then Robert specifically says, "It's not his fault I didn't listen." That is peak ineffectual dad. That is powerful mid-father energy. Uh-huh. And also, just real quick, when Robert became king, John Aaron became his hand. And for the rest of John Aaron's career, he basically cleaned up Robert's messes. I mean, I think there was some lip service given to, like, oh, he tried to get Robert to change and be a better king, whatever, but he, like, gave up, basically. And that's the thing. Instead of putting his foot down and forcing Robert to be a better king, a better person in general, John Aaron spent his time cleaning up after Robert. Mm. Sure, there was love there. That was an act of love, not necessarily like, oh, fuck, I have to make sure that no one knows our king's a moron. It was because he cares about Robert, and he was being a good person, but he didn't try and reinforce good values in essentially his foster son, but instead made life as comfortable for him as possible.
Okay, I have some comments. Hillary, would you like to go?
Sure. So interestingly, John Aaron was actually on my list of possible mediocre dads too, but with a bunch of question marks after his name. Because generally, I would agree with you. I feel like he obviously had a really good impact on Ned, because Ned was willing to learn the lessons that he was teaching. Robert obviously wasn't, and I agree that John didn't, you know, push it hard enough. And obviously, ironically, he was he appears to be a pretty absent father to his only actual son. He lets Lysa basically completely take over his care. He doesn't prepare him for lordship that well, even though obviously, you know, Robin's really young when he dies. But I would tend to put him in the good dad category simply because he literally rebelled against the king to protect Ned and Robert, which ultimately, I mean, a lot of people wouldn't necessarily do, especially for their, you know, adopted sons.
That's interesting that you point out. I think, obviously, when we're talking about, like, the role of a father figure, obviously, I think a father figure has to nurture their children. But I think there's no real, like, especially in the feudal society of Westeros, there's no real more dangerous thing than a rebellion against the established order, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and he facilitated that.
Yeah, he
because
did.
It's what his kids wanted.
Well, yeah, I mean, he definitely goes along with everything, right? And the fact that he serves his hand is for so long and he basically keeps the kingdom together is also like a very important point. I don't know necessarily if that makes him like so how do I put it? I feel like it's possible.
Here's the thing though. What is the one thing we know about Jon Arryn? He maintains the status quo. He does. He goes along with stuff. We don't know very much about, like, people keep saying he's a good person, but they also say, like, oh, but he was also kind of an idiot. And he didn't, like, he wasn't savvy. He wasn't a politician. He was just sort of, like, honorable. Maybe, just maybe, a mediocre man maintaining the status quo of his kind of shitty king, but a king who's also brought sort of peace to the realm, isn't the best father.
No, I actually think that in some respects, as Hillary pointed out, I feel like the fact that Jon Arryn neglected his real children, I think is a major mark against him, right? Because an okay dad wouldn't completely neglect one of his kids in favor of somebody who isn't his child.
I mean, is Robin his kid?
Well, he doesn't know.
Yes.
There's a pretty strong theory that might be... Well, there's a pretty strong theory that might be Peter's kid, to be honest, but regardless, like, people say neglected his child. What evidence do we have that that actually happened? Like, again, Robin was very young when John died, and Lysa took over, but that's not necessarily because, like, John didn't want to have anything to do with his kid. Lysa might have just taken over. Lysa was not, is in the show, in the book, not the most mentally sound person.
Right. Well, so, I mean, obviously, Jon Arryn is in a position of power over Lysa, and he knows that Lysa's, like, batshit. So, the fact that he doesn't really intervene and just kind of lets her go off, like, obviously, her relationship with Robin, the weirdness between the two of them, is not a new development since Jon died. So, he, you know, allowed his kid to be, yeah, taken over by kind of a kooky woman who was not doing a good job of preparing him for his future at all.
I mean, look, Robin Arryn's gonna have the strongest skeleton in all of Westeros by the end of his lifetime, but the thing is, Jon Arryn, as I said previously, goes along with things. He tries to placate. He wants to keep people happy, basically. Like, the one huge act of love that we rarely know about him is him joining Ned and Robert's rebellions.
But well, no, I mean, he was kind of more of a driving force behind that. Like, he wasn't just joining them. I'm pretty sure the king commanded him to send Ned and Robert to him, and he's the one who initially said, no, I'm not going to do that.
Yeah,
Well, there we go. That, I mean, that's a protective act from a father figure. That's good stuff. But
I mean, literally, the Mad King kills his heir, right? That's like the casus belli for Jon Arryn to join the rebellion is that his heir was Wood Brandon Stark when the Mad King, you know.
Wait, what do you mean his heir?
His nephew, in the books, Albert Aron. Oh, unless you're talking about the TV show.
Well, I was talking about the TV show, but it's a good thing to... I haven't read Game of Thrones in a while, but it's a good thing to, like, mention that. Because that's another factor. Like, it's not purely motivated by a love for Robert and Ned. It's also motivated by the fact that the Mad King did shit to everyone.
Yeah,
He had to go. He was a dangerous influence on the country. And that's, like... One of the greater acts of love we actually hear from John Aron is that even though he had his own reasons to join in this war, to be a driving force behind this war, as you guys have said, he did fully trust Ned and Robert to essentially co-lead the war with him. John Aron was a much older person than they were.
Yeah.
Probably a respected general.
Yeah, but he was... Yeah, but isn't that a point in his favor, right? Just if you're an older guy, you don't necessarily have to be, like, leading the charges on the front lines to be commanding, right? You just have to sit in the tent and dish out the strategy, right? Robert Baratheon wins a lot of battles, but he's not what I would call a great tactician.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's why one of my favorite scenes in the show is him talking to Cersei, because it's, like, the only time we ever hear him sound like he knows what he's talking about. But... My point is this. The greatest moment of trust and love between John Aron and Ned Stark and Robert Baratheon is the rebellion. And after that's over, it feels like John Aron keeps that image of those two in his head the whole time. He keeps just trusting them, trying to placate them where he can, and that's why he lets Robert run rampant through the entire kingdom. He allows Robert to push the kingdom like 3 trillion gold into debt. And he lets Robert like sire 100 bastards, even though that started a literal civil war.
Yeah, but look,
in the Targaryen line not too long ago.
Look. I don't know. So I feel like you're making your case, like you're drawing a circle and then you're drawing a bigger circle around that. And what's happening is I think you're pushing your case further and further from the fact that he's being okay. Because either he's very, very negligent in terms of his role, or he's really, really good because he dies basically for the conspiracy about Robert's kids, doesn't he? Right. He's investigating it and he gets killed. Right. Would an okay dad I need to check out...
I don't think we actually find out if he was killed because of that necessarily. Because we don't know who kills him in the books, right?
Yeah. I'm referring, of course... In the show, it's more clear that,
The Lannisters did it.
Yeah, but...
Well, Lysa
No,
did
the
it,
Lannisters
blamed
didn't
the Lannisters.
Do it. Yeah.
Yeah, Lysa
Littlefinger
did it.
Littlefinger framed the Lannisters for it. So technically, that... wasn't the case. He didn't die specifically for Robert's, for the conspiracy behind Robert's children. It's set up to look like he has been killed because he discovered the true parentage of Robert's children. But again, that was a setup by Lysa and Littlefinger.
It's a double-double
cross.
And
that might not even be the case. Like, all we know about him concerning Robert's children is that he visited a lot of them to make sure that they were okay.
Again, that's also maybe a mark that he's not just an okay dad. Like, I feel like checking up on all of those kids is probably...
Okay.
No,
here's my final argument.
Words are the seed is strong, though. So he did probably know what was going on with Robert Baratheon and his kids.
Or that was in reference to Robert. Anyway,
right.
Here's my final argument, is that John Aron is a very loving... very caring individual that is ultimately ineffectual. There is perhaps one moment that we know of, one big moment in which he is truly a big part of his foster kids' lives and doing what's right and trusting them to be good and teaching them and so on. And then after that, he's just a force of... what's the word? Maintainment, I guess? Like, he just attempts to keep everything as peaceful as possible. I mean, he's working hard to hold the realm together, but not make it better.
Yeah.
He is ineffectual, but he does it out of love. And that's why I think he's an okay, he's the most okay dad.
All right. So you've approached the shark tank. There is a shark right there. We are going to dunk John Aaron into the shark tank if he fails the muster.
This is a very Spartan way of deciding who the... Okay.
So, Hillary, what do you think? Yay or nay, John Aaron?
I'm going to have to go with nay, just because I think he actually is a good parent. Or I think in terms of, like, you know, not a lot of people would go to the extent that he did to protect his foster sons. So I would say that regardless of what happened after, that kind of automatically puts him in good dad territory.
Yeah, I think I'm also going to go on nay. Unfortunately, Callum, I think your taste in dads is too good, because John Aaron, I think, is a good guy. I think he's a good dad.
They warned me of this much. This is my my fatal flaw.
Yeah, hubris. Okay. Hillary, you're up next. You may leave the shark, the bench, I guess, that we're all sitting on. I don't know. I have this idea, viewers at home, that we're in a...
We're at the Eyrie.
Yeah, we're
at... What's happening is we're at the Eyrie. We dropped John Aaron through the moon door. You're allowed to bring your dad before the moon door now and explain to us whether we should push him through or not.
Okay. Okay, so this one is kind of a wild card even for me, because I'm not quite sure where I land.
Oh, my goodness.
But I would say maybe Otto Hightower.
Whoa!
Obviously...
No. Nay. Incorrect.
Obviously, I don't want to get into, like, any potential spoilers for House of the Dragon, but I think in terms of what he actually managed to accomplish for his children is exceptionally impressive. Being a second son of House Hightower and getting his daughter to become the queen is a massive political play that obviously would have been probably a massive win for him had Viserys not decided to keep Rhaenyra as his heir. But I think that I don't want to hold him entirely responsible for Alicent's children, because obviously he's their grandfather and not their father. But given what a good political player he was, the fact that, like, Aegon was extremely unprepared to potentially be king or be a good king seems like a massive oversight on his part and a large failing. Again, I know he wasn't necessarily at court for some of his childhood either.
But he did, like, interact with Aegon. We saw them together at Laena's funeral.
Right. And so, again, with that, knowing what he was ultimately probably going to have to do, knowing that a civil war with Rhaenyra was coming, making sure that Aegon was, like, the best king he could possibly be and was extremely politically savvy would have been the most obvious play out of anything. And he, I guess more so, like, he kept things under his own control rather than teaching his children and grandchildren how to handle it by themselves, which I think, you know, is a fatal flaw. So there's, you know, aspects of him where he is extremely accomplished as a parent, and then aspects of him where he is a complete and total failure, which I guess kind of leaves him in the middle in the end, possibly.
So the argument that you're making is that he has very high highs, but also very, very lows. And if we average that out, he's a flat plane, sort of.
Yeah.
I have some questions.
Okay.
I want to bring up a point real quick. He didn't want Aegon to be king. That was his older brother, like, basically saying to him, hey, go and do this thing. Otto was answering to someone, and that's why he started pushing Aegon to be king.
So, actually, you can go. No, go ahead, please.
Oh, just that, you know, that's not something that's established that clearly in the books at all. That's something that's kind of implied in the show. But I also think again, Otto being a pretty savvy political player, he understood, regardless of what his brother wanted, that it was going to come down to that. That if Aegon didn't become king, then he was going to die. All of Alicent's children were going to die, and Alicent was probably going to die. So, yeah, it was never... I don't think, even regardless of what he wanted, he knew that Aegon was going to have to be king if there was any chance of the Hightower Targaryen line surviving.
Okay, Emilia, you had questions?
So, Hillary, what do you think that Otto has... So I know people have vacillated on this, especially in the anti-green like discourse. I know there's a lot of people who think that Otto Hightower is like the devil incarnate, which I think is actually wrong and incorrect. But do you think that Otto Hightower actually has genuine affection for people like Alicent, people like, you know, her children? Or do you think that he's purely just calculating that, like, if he doesn't do this, then the Hightowers might all be dead?
No, I think he has genuine affection for the people in his family. Because, again, I mean, the Hightower family is a massive family. It's not, even if the Hightower Targaryens... were all killed, it wouldn't have an effect on House Hightower in general, likely. And so I think, especially with the way, even with the way that Viserys is portrayed in the books and in the show, there's a certain, like, aside from him being king, as far as husbands go, as horrifying as it is, he's a pretty good one in the sense that, like, you know, Otto knew that Alicent wouldn't be abused, or not in, like, the traditional way that you would think in Westeros. She wouldn't be mistreated. He was generally, you know, an okay guy. And at least at the time when Otto was hanged, it would have put Alicent in a position where he could watch over her and protect her and her children in a way that he wouldn't be able to for any other possible match that she would have had. So I think that as much as a parent could care, I think he did.
Can I, real quick, okay, so I've not read Fire and Blood. I'm going to be going purely from what I've seen on the show. Is that just, is everyone cool with
yeah.
that?
Yeah.
What about Otto's son? He featured in, like, one episode, and then he stopped being relevant because he was not as useful to Otto as Alicent was. But Otto does have a son, and Daemon, like, unhorsed him, and we don't necessarily have evidence that Otto's son got badly hurt from that or anything, but he didn't look super concerned when that happened.
Yeah. So in the book, I'm pretty sure Otto has more sons besides Gawain. And I don't know that their other kids were playing that much of a role. I think they may have been in Old Town, which again gives you, it's hard to judge how he was as a parent because he literally wasn't there. But yeah, so I wouldn't.
It's just, it's weird to me that he didn't like bring any of his other kids to court.
So,
you know, like, I understand that Alicent is the most prominent because of her position in the court, but, I mean, why not also have your son there and try and...
Well,
if you have 8 sons, put one of them in the Kingsguard, man.
Well, you know, the thing is, Otto, again, because I'm starting to a little bit to maybe be won over to this, I think Otto Hightower recognizes that he's the second son, right? And as a second son, his own male children don't really have a path to the succession.
Value.
Right? They don't really.
Yeah.
Right? And that's just feudalism, right? So he recognizes that the star actually rests on Alicent. And she's the make or break linchpin. As soon as it becomes possible for Alicent to actually have a chance at becoming, you know, inserted into the Targaryen dynasty, she kind of becomes the only one who matters, because if they win with her big, and if they lose, well, there's a possibility that if they lose big, then they might all be killed. So I feel like,
look,
it becomes like you have to, you know, she's the most important character, but I also don't necessarily think that we can assume malice, like, just because his other kids weren't there.
No, I'm not assuming malice or anything. I was assuming like negligence.
So looking at the wiki now, Gawain at least was in King's Landing with Otto and Allison. He just wasn't doing that much. Like, he was a knight and he was an officer in the city watch.
Yeah, Gawain was in the same place that Alicent and Viserys' wedding was, off screen.
Right.
Okay, let me bring up one other thing before we move on to the voting, is that there is a scene in, I think, episode 9. Spoilers, by the way, if you haven't seen the show, you absolutely should. There's been a lot of trailers for season 2. It looks good. In episode 9, which is a very green-centric episode, when Alicent reveals that they've got Aegon. Like, she found Aegon first. She's going to get him to the coronation and everything. She's the one who's essentially in control of the situation now, and she confronts Otto. The thing that he says to her in, like, his admission of defeat is that she looks like her mother. So, and that's, like, not a unnecessarily strange thing to say to your kid, but it is sort of framed as a moment that he's finally seeing her beyond her political uses, and the way that he does that is by comparing her to someone he genuinely loved. So it does feel, in a way, like, maybe I'm reading too much into it, but it does sort of feel like he doesn't actually see Alicent for who she is, beyond, like, the fact that she's his daughter. Like, that is her only identity. And it's also kind of like earlier in the season when she attacks Rhaenyra. Like, he's super proud of her, and then goes like, okay, now here's how you spin this to your advantage. And it doesn't seem like there's any sort of concern for her well-being at all.
Yeah, I don't know how I would read that. I might read it sort of in a similar way as you, but maybe slightly different, in that, like, he doesn't see Allison as a person beyond his daughter, because he presumes that she would want whatever he wants, or whatever, you know, he thinks is the right path, she would also think is the right path. And coming to that realization, like, with what Allison says, that, or in the show anyway, that she wanted whatever he impressed on her to want. So, again, I don't necessarily feel like that indicates a lack of caring, or just, like, a lack of understanding that maybe being a politician or aiming this high wouldn't be something that she wanted for herself.
All right, well, I'm kind of on the fence about this. Amelia, what do you think?
Yeah, I think, in terms of my assessment, like, when you first said Otto Hightower, I was like, whoa, that's crazy. Otto Hightower, really? Otto Hightower? But in the classic Hills Alive tradition of having a hot take that actually doesn't actually sound that hot when you... It's actually much colder than I think some people would give it credit for. I think... No, I'm going to have to say nay, because I think ultimately Otto Hightower is too polarizing. I think even though he has a lot of highs and lows, I don't think that the median output of that is a flat plane. I think to some people, he's too much of a villain, and to some people, he's actually kind of a hero. Like, if you think about what he does for House Hightower, it's pretty crazy, right? It's like one of the political upsets of the century. So I think, no, I think he's just too good / bad to be okay, which is sort of my take on it.
I'm in a similar position where I'm leaning towards a yay, but I'm gonna have to go with nay, because he's just, it's hard to get a read on how he actually thinks. Like, the way he interacts with his grandchildren, the fact that he seems to appreciate Aemond. Is his name Aemond?
I haven't watched the show.
Okay. I have watched the show, just not in a while. The way he seems to be, like, more impressed with Aemond than Aegon, purely because Aemond has done more for the fact, like, Aemond is more useful. It feels like you could make the argument that he's trying to do his best to make sure his family's okay and everything, and he did like you said, pick out a suitor that wouldn't attack Alicent physically, at the very least. It just does feel that he's so good at using people that it's blurred the lines as to whether he cares about them or not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I said. Like, I don't actually think it evens out to a flat plane, because I think it's just a very, very bumpy line.
I think that's fair.
All lines are just dots in a row.
Well, you know, if you asked a physicist about that, I'm sure you'd get a much more... a line isn't just a, you know, it's just it's dots. It's probabilities, man. You know?
That was a hell of a sentence you just murdered. Well, who's your dad, Emilio? We've thrown Otto Hightower from the highest tower in all of Westeros. So present your father.
Okay, sure. Okay. Right. This is also, I think, a little bit of a long shot, but here we go. I think it's possible that in terms of my okayest dad, I think Robert Baratheon would count.
No. Wrong. I'm sorry.
I'm
he's
interested
based
to hear
as hell,
more.
But he's a bad dad.
So hear me out, right? Hear me out for why I think he's an okay dad, right? Now, I think it's very important to understand what the context of being the king is, right? And what is, like, the standards and norms of expectations for you as the king, right? I don't think Robert was particularly out of line for the behavior expected of him and the way that he reacted. So, for example, I know that Robert hit Joffrey, right? But Joffrey had disemboweled a cat. So, you know, this is before psychology exists. This is before, like, psychotherapy exists, therapy, etc. Everybody's just kind of medicated with alcohol and trauma, right? I think that Robert wasn't particularly...
the perfect combination.
I don't think Robert was particularly terrible to his children. He just didn't care about them a lot. I think he was very apathetic about them. I think Robert was lost in his cups because he had done the thing that he supposedly thought would make him happy, which is to become king. And then he found out that actually being king really sucks.
That great line from the show? Like, she left a hole in my heart and seven kingdoms couldn't fill it.
Yeah, but he can't even remember her face.
I mean, yeah, but that's like... They knew each other when they were like 16 or whatever.
Yeah, so it's like Lyanna is not a real... I don't think Lyanna is a real love. I think Lyanna just represents the freedom that Robert wished he could have had, right? He just thinks, oh, if I had Lyanna, everything would be better. But, you know, the reality of the matter is Robert was never fit to rule. I don't necessarily think he's, like, a bad guy. I don't think he's an amazing father, but I think that, like, he has instincts that... you know, obviously he has a lot of illegitimate children, and that's not excusable, but I do think that, again, I think...
But that's like a bad husband father.
Robert's infidelity is not a product of the fact that... I think he just hates being around Cersei, and he has no self-control when it comes to these sorts of things. And so Robert's just like... He's got lots of issues... But I don't. I just think it makes him an absent father, not a negligent one or an abusive one. I don't think he's like, in the way that like some people say that like Robert was like the best king, you know, considering
in comparison,
because he just wasn't the
like
worst.
Relative.
Yeah, he just wasn't the worst in comparison. Like, you know, I feel like in terms of
Viserys was technically a better king than Robert.
Yeah, I mean, you can make an argument like that. Viserys at least tried to do something. Robert was just very asleep at the wheel. But again, I don't think he was terrible. I think Robert and Cersei, they had a toxic relationship. And I think if circumstances had been different, I think everybody would regard Robert as like one of the best kings ever. You know, he'd be like regarded as like this mythical sort of like King Arthur figure, you know, a larger than life warrior who was like this really handsome, amazing guy. Who...
And all the history books would stop after the rebellion.
Yeah, and all the stuff after the rebellion.
He won a war and then nothing happened for like 30 years.
Yeah. Yeah, so my argument is that if we think about what Robert could have been, if we think about the standards of kings, especially in the context of like fatherhood as being the king, I don't think Robert is especially egregious or terrible. I don't think he's especially abusive. I don't think he's especially like attentive or, you know, like obviously his children end up bad, but is that really his fault? Or is it also just the fact that he's in a completely toxic relationship with Cersei? And Cersei's also kind of messed up, you know?
Can I real quick interject here? Tommen and Marcella don't end up bad, like, at all. And Robert barely has any interaction with them. Like, the only one who rarely ends up bad is Joffrey, and that's the one that Robert had the most interactions with.
Yeah, but that's also because, well, I would argue that Robert and Cersei had the most interactions with Joffrey, because they were expecting him to be the king, right? He was the next in line. But the fact that Marcella and Tommen don't end up terrible while Robert's alive, I think it's maybe an argument that he's an okay dad. Not the worst dad.
But he never interacts with them.
Yeah, but...
like, we've never seen them talk or anything.
Yeah, but I wouldn't say that he was necessarily abusive to them, just because we don't see the interactions.
Yeah, but, like, that's a pretty low bar, dude.
I mean, we're clearing some low bars. Look, Robert's a fat
also,
man. The idea that he
like,
could...
Like, I know, okay. Well, this is Westeros. Okay, everyone has a toxic view of masculinity, right? Like, we're not gonna expect Robert Baratheon, the uber macho, I can kill 50 people with a hammer kind of guy to have a great view on what a man should be in modern society. But, like, the first thing that happens with the whole Arya's wolf and Joffrey conflict, that's that small, like, microcosm of the further Lannister-Stark conflict later on. Mm-hmm. When that happens and Robert has to mediate, he doesn't, like, check to make sure that Joffrey is okay. He goes like, oh, you're shit at fighting. Despite the fact that Joffrey was fighting a wolf.
Maybe.
I mean, I feel like, I don't know. It's hard for me because that's, like, my lone moment where I agree with Robert when he's just like, this isn't a big deal, so why are you guys freaking out about it? Like, I think honestly that's true. I mean, like, kids do fight. Like, yes, obviously being attacked by a wolf is pretty wild, but like, it's not the end of the world. He's fine.
The whole conflict is, I agree with Robert, like, kids have a fight, they should say sorry and whatever. That's fine. But my point is that in terms of, like, his son, in terms of Joffrey, he doesn't go like, oh, are you okay? Because that wolf... that actual fucking dire wolf attacked you? No, he's just like, you let a little girl beat you up, fucking pussy. And then that's like the whole interaction. That's not a good father. That's a bad father.
Whoa.
Also, one of Robert's bastards is at Storm's End.
Yeah, but again, Robert is not a good guy. He's not a great husband. I'm not arguing that. I just think, again, you know, in the context of that situation, I think Robert is an experienced fighter. I think he is able to look at Joffrey and go, okay, so it wasn't you weren't actually in danger. I think if Joffrey were much more injured, I think Robert would have responded differently. But he assessed the situation as like, he's not actually hurt, and the real issue is that my son kind of can't like handle himself. You know, Robert is realizing, oh, this kid that I hoped would be a little me, a little, you know, guy swinging a hammer, warrior kind of guy, is actually not that guy. And I think Robert is more disappointed than anything else.
Yeah, because Robert is inherently incredibly selfish.
That's true. A lot of guys on this show/book series are inherently selfish, but we're not arguing about whether or not they're good people. I think we're just...
Look, I'm going to have to say nay. I think Robert is just like, he's too negligent for me.
Okay, that's fair.
He's not involved enough. Like, I get, he didn't screw anyone up, besides maybe Joffrey, but that was like... It takes two to tango.
I think Joffrey was the lost situation. As soon as Joffrey was born, I feel like Joffrey was the lost cause, right? Your mother is Cersei Lannister and your father is Robert Baratheon.
No, he isn't. but yeah, it's like Joffrey, that one's a write-off, but he wasn't involved in like any of his other kids' lives, even though he didn't legitimize Edric Storm, but he knows that Edric Storm is his son. Edric Storm has been raised at Storm's End, and presumably while Robert was in the capital. Like, sure, he gave Edric a better life, but he also abandoned him in a castle where everyone knows that Edric is a bastard and the king's bastard, and they're going to treat him very... Like, Jon Snow is the bastard of Ned Stark, who's almost, like, universally loved by his people, and Jon Snow had a rough time. Like, Edric Storm isn't going to have a great time. And Robert just let that happen.
Okay. Sure. I've made my pitch. We can dunk. We need to get the Shark Tank stretcher.
Well, no. What does Hillary think?
Well, I would say, I think I'm actually, based on our standards that we're looking for mediocre dads in Westeros, I'd probably say yay.
Hey, I'll take that.
We half push Robert out of the moon door. He's stuck.
Okay.
We need the door stretcher.
Yeah, okay. Who's next?
let me hit you with this one. I've been racking my brains, and you're right, Emilio. My dad taste is too good. I keep coming up with good fathers. Let me hit you with this. Stannis Baratheon.
Oh my god, are we just going to talk about all the Baratheons?
Yeah, except for Renly.
Wait, Hillary, do you have Renly on your list?
I don't. He doesn't have a child, does he?
And he's not a father figure to anyone.
Yeah.
I mean, he's a daddy to someone, but he's not. but no, Stannis Baratheon.
Stannis Baratheon. Are we talking...
He doesn't particularly...
Are we talking book Stannis or TV Stannis? Because that's... That would heavily influence my perception about whether or not he's okay.
I want to say book Stannis, because book Stannis is better.
He's...
But I don't remember every... Like, he's a better character.
Look.
But I mean, remember everything.
Doesn't he set... He sets his only child on fire.
That shows Stannis.
In the show, right? So, book Stannis
has...
Yeah, in
the book we haven't gotten there.
Well, I mean, if he does, I will be very upset.
Yeah, but that book is enough. That book is enough. Also... In the book, Stannis argues against that. He goes like, no, I'm not doing that. And also, Stannis spares no expense to cure Shireen's grayscale. Like, the only reason Shireen is, like, the sole survivor of grayscale is because Stannis got healers in from everywhere. A shy all over.
I do actually kind of wonder about how he managed to do that. I'm tempted to try and maybe make a video about it, because it's really interesting that they actually kind of maybe do it, you know?
Yeah.
I'm it's my headcanon that that's how he met Melisandre.
Oh, that's...
Is through that process.
Oh, that she was the one who showed up and, like, hey, I can...
Or that, because he kept, like, the story is that he kept, like, bringing in healers and magic users, quote-unquote, mm-hmm. to try and basically do everything, and it makes sense that Melisandre came and was like, oh, Lord of the Light, and he was like, that's horseshit. And then she cures Shireen, and he's like, oh, maybe.
I mean, that's very interesting.
Because it is kind of weird that Stannis Baratheon, of all people, decided to become the savior of a foreign religion.
Yeah.
I mean, Stannis is one of my most favorite characters in this fictional work.
Oh, he's tons of fun.
He's dead. You know, I gotta make a video about his naval exploits, because again, I keep teasing that video that I'm gonna make about the naval stuff in Game of Thrones, and I need to get around to doing it.
Look, Stannis the Manus is so much fun to just follow, because he's like Ned Stark without a personality, and it's great. Watching this fucking sheath of a man. Watching this 2-foot pole of a human being trying to be political when he's just like, can we just start hitting each other with swords, please? That's what I'm good at. It's so much fun. Especially because he's at the center of, like, the magic plot.
I mean, I don't think he's Azor Ahai, but, you know...
No, but he's, like, he's there. Yeah, he experiences probably the most magic out of
it. Yeah, literally, you know, with the shadow... Demon.
In the books, at least.
But that whole thing, the assassination, that's like, phew.
Well, that happens, and also, like, Edric Storm is, I think, like, he prepares to execute Edric Storm for Melisandre's ritual. Like, if you've watched the show, what happened to Gendry was supposed to happen to Edric. And then Davos frees him and everything, and that's the conflict. But it's really interesting to see, like, Stannis... But that's besides the point. We're on a tangent now. Stannis is a decent father. He doesn't connect to his daughter. He doesn't really interact with her. He doesn't really seem to teach her anything, but he does care for her. Like, he works his hardest to save his daughter from an incurable disease.
Yeah, that's why I don't think he's an okay dad. I think the fact that he went this extra mile, because, like, you're right, he doesn't spend a lot of time with her. I can barely remember. I don't even think there was any interaction between him and his daughter in the books. I could be mistaken, guys. It's been a while since I've read those books, but I think that the fact that he does this, when he doesn't, it's not like Shireen is his, like, the firstborn son that's going to inherit, you know, like, Shireen is his daughter. And unfortunately, women are...
But his only daughter.
Yeah, women are kind of disposable in the story, right? That's, like, one of the major problematic elements, you know, is that women are generally treated as more disposable. The fact that Stannis goes above and beyond, I think, demonstrates that he really cares about her in a way. And maybe he just doesn't connect to her because he's a bit weird like that, you know?
Yeah, but the thing is, you can't measure fatherhood in terms of, like, big moments only. It's also day-to-day stuff. They live in the same fucking castle, and he doesn't talk to her.
What do you think, Hillary?
He, like, Fiona's her. She's in the tower, and he just doesn't interact with his cool daughter, whose life he saved.
What do you think, Hillary?
I think I actually am kind of leaning towards yay. Just because Stannis is the guy who always does exactly what's required of him, or what's expected of him. And I think that probably holds true to Shireen too. Obviously, we're talking about book Stannis, who hasn't set her on fire yet. But
yes,
like,
yeah,
in terms of you know, what a father is, or what you would consider a mediocre father in Westeros, it's the person who does what's required of them and nothing more, right? So that probably does apply to Stannis.
But does he not show extraordinary care for his children?
Well, no. He does one thing. Is that an act of love, or is that an act of duty?
It's not just a once-off thing, right? What we're talking about here, Stannis has to spend a substantial amount of money, time, and resources to cure an incurable disease, as you said. It could have taken months, it could have taken years for him to do this. It's like trying to cure your kid's cancer, you know? It's not like an easy thing. It probably consumes your whole life if you were worried about it, you know? Like, I feel like that's an extra... it's quote-unquote one big thing, but it's like, oh, I just cured cancer, right? That's just one thing, you know? But that's what he did.
But consider this. He did that so that Shireen can spend the rest of her life being ignored by him.
I don't know if there's enough evidence to really say that. We don't really see them have much interactions. We don't know if they're, like, fundamentally ignore. If he's, like, ignoring her because he's got so many things that is going on, or if he's ignoring her because he just doesn't want to be around her, right? I feel like those are two different...
Probably never gonna...
No, obviously, but if your dad is so busy that he has no time for you because he's trying to put food on the table, that's different from, oh, your dad is just, like, going to the bar every afternoon and he doesn't want to hang around you. Like, those are two...
But Shireen doesn't know that.
Yeah, but... You know, we have a bird's eye view regardless, right? And I think it's not just important to consider her perspective. I think we have to consider the other perspective as well. Like, yeah, maybe it's that case. Like,
look. Okay, we're not arguing here whether or not Stannis loves Shireen. I think he does. I think it's pretty clear that he does. Melisandre brings up burning her, I believe, in, like, the fifth book or something, and he says no. We're not doing that. Like, he obviously cares about her, but he also doesn't interact with her. And that could just because he's a weird person. He does what's required of him and everything. But that still makes him generally a pretty mediocre dad. He allows Shireen, his only daughter, whom's cancer he cured, to spend her entire life basically only in the company of a possessed clown.
Okay.
Like, that's it. That's, like, didn't buy her a dog. God or a god's
wait, but,
vessel.
Yeah, but is that not then moving him back into bad territory? Because that...
I think that's the thing. He oscillates so much between good and bad that he ends up being in the middle. It's an Otto Hightower bumpy line.
Oh, no.
But better. Smoother.
Oh, no. What do you think, Hillary? Well, yay or nay?
I think I'm going to have to stick with yay.
Yes.
You know what, Callum? I'm going to go with yay
do
as
it
well.
To me.
I'm going to go with...
Hell yeah!
My eternal loyalty to Stannis the Manus, I have to put yay on this one.
The one true king of Westeros wins again.
By doing exactly what's required of him and nothing more.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
I go to high-five him and he looks at me strangely.
You know, you do have to respect
he sends
the
Davos to
like,
do it.
Ah, I will do... You know, like... it's a guy at work. He's like, he shows up, he does his
okay,
work, and
so
then he goes home.
We've elected a winner. We've elected a winner of Most Mediocre Dad, but we still have some time left in the episode. So, like what we did last time, just to let you guys know, there was a bit of a technical issue last time, and that's why we're doing this again. But like we did last time, what we're going to do now is, we have a kingpin. Who can knock him down? Emilio, Hillary, pitch me your final dads. And if we can find one more mediocre than Stannis, they will be crowned the new king.
All right, ladies first.
Okay. So my other mediocre dad is Mace Tyrell.
Oh, this was the previous ringer.
Yes. And I think he's a good one. I couldn't really think of anybody who was more mediocre than him in terms of... you know, being kind of a hands-off dad, letting seemingly his mother kind of take control of the entire family, including, you know, training his own heir to become the leader of House Tyrell and the leader of the entire Reach. I think that Mace is just kind of the guy who, like, wants to have a good time and he wants to, like, chill out. He doesn't care about politics beyond... being a social climber. And so I think there's another aspect of his characterization that's kind of an interesting, again, it's like he hits highs and lows, in that he obviously has wanted Margaery to be the queen since she was born. But the way in which he and the rest of his family go about this is actually, like, really kind of batshit. Like, it's an extremely dangerous political game to play.
Yeah, because, like, at this point, the Lannisters are losing the war, and they're like, we'll side with you.
Right. Well, no. So it actually starts with they're trying to put her in front of Robert Baratheon in the hopes that eventually Cersei will die, and then Margaery will become... queen. But obviously there's still three children who are in the line of succession, so even if that were to happen, it's not like her children would be moved to the front just because she's now Robert's wife. The same goes for Renly. It's like, okay, they marry her off to someone who is trying to make a claim to be king, but he really doesn't have that claim. They're literally just relying on the fact, like, oh, we probably have the martial force to put Renly on the throne if we want to, so let's throw in with him. And then obviously when he dies, they go to the Lannisters. Again, when the Lannisters are on the verge of losing the throne, and when it's become common knowledge that Joffrey and Tommen aren't in the line of succession either, that they're not Robert Baratheon's actual children. So... again, it shows a weird kind of short-sightedness in that, like, okay, they want Margaery to have this title, but they don't really appreciate the meaning behind it, or, like, they don't really care whether or not she actually has the power of the name queen behind her. They're just like, oh, okay, she'll be a queen with this guy, let's marry her to him. And then, oh, well, he's dead now, so let's marry her to this guy. Like, it just, yeah,
yeah,
so again, it's like, oh... Yeah, they're aiming high, but then in a weird way aiming low, which I guess kind of leaves them in the middle, ultimately.
I think we're running into a similar problem with Stannis, though, where we don't actually see Mace interact very much with his kids, and we don't have, like, a POV from him. to see if he actually, like, ah, oh, this is my daughter, I love her. I want her to be queen because that'll put her in a good position. Or if he's like, I want her to be queen because that'll put our family in a good position. Or if he's like, it's what you're supposed to do.
I don't think Mace does.
So we don't know.
Yeah, no, so I have to admit, I've soured a little bit on Mace Tyrell as the most okayest mediocre dad. And I think the reason for that is just, with everything that we've discussed here, I think we've really focused in on the ways in which people interact with their children. And as you said, you pointed out yourself, Hillary, Elena is the one who's interacting with the children. Elena is the one who's, like, doing all of this stuff, you know? Mace is just kind of there.
Mace Tyrell interacts more with Tycho Nestoris than he does with Marjorie.
Yeah, I think...
Yeah, I mean,
again,
kind of,
I think
right?
that's a like, that's... fair point. I think it's a fair point, but I also feel like, again, if we're looking for mediocrity specifically, then kind of being a hands-off parent or an absent parent is a pretty strong hallmark of being a mediocre parent, right? Of just like letting somebody else take over. And based on what we know about Mace, like, yeah, the children are probably better off being raised and taught by Elena than being raised and taught by him, because she's a much better political player and she's a lot smarter than he is. But the fact that he kind of, I don't know, like he sets his children up. Like if you look at all of his kids, Willis is his heir. He's pretty sharp. He seems well prepared for the role, regardless of whether or not that's Mace's doing. Garland is an accomplished fighter. He now has his own keep that they took from Florence. Obviously, Loras, the youngest son, is in the King's Guard, which is a huge position of honor. And Marjorie is the queen. So basically, even in like birth order, you know, his first son is in one of the best positions an oldest son can be in. His second son is also in one of the best positions a second son can be in. Same with Loras. His third son is in, you know, one of the highest positions a third son can achieve. And his daughter is in the highest position that any woman can achieve. So he, in terms of actual accomplishments, he sets his children up in exactly the way that he's supposed to. But on the flip side of that, obviously, they're in incredibly precarious positions that are likely to get them killed or hurt or, you know, something catastrophic is likely to happen to them because the Tyrells have played such a risky game of politics. So it's sort of a weighted, again, it's, you know, he got them where they're supposed to be, but at what cost? And what is the cost going to be at the end of their story?
But that's the thing, is that we don't know. Like, he didn't get them where they were supposed to be. Elena did.
Right.
But we don't know what kind of influence he had. Like, the only thing we know is, I think you brought this up in the last time we talked about it, is that he organized the fight between Oberyn Martell and
Willis? Yeah.
Yeah, or and rather, then Willis got paralyzed from that.
Yeah, well, no. So he encouraged Willis to become, like, a fighter younger than he was ready. I don't think it was specifically arranged for him to fight with Oberyn. And then, he winds up injuring his leg. He's not paralyzed, but is lame.
He's functionally can't walk.
Yeah, I think we
no, he can't. He's just, he has, like, a limp.
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
Oh, okay. So he becomes Laris Strong.
Sure.
Well, every generation's gotta have a rat guy. But no, I think the implication is there that Mace checked out of his fatherly duties when he felt like he made the wrong call with his kid. Like, oh, I'm going to do this, and then they get hurt. Well, I guess I don't want to be involved in raising them at all, because I'll just mess it up, and then I'll just leave them to Elena. Right?
Yeah. And I've also kind of soured on Mace, because I don't think it's a good hallmark of mediocrity to not be there. Like, I'm a mediocre president of China because I'm not the president of China. Like, it doesn't, you can't, like, you have to be in some manner involved in your kid's life, and we just never see Mace do anything after the Willis incident. Like, maybe he did check out. Maybe that happened and he was like, oh, I'm bad at this. My mom should take over. And that's fine, I guess. That's a decent decision. But then that's the last thing that happens. That's the last, like, tally mark we can make on his fatherhood report card.
Because he stops being after that.
Yeah, and that's pretty bad.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, okay. Well, wow, we in total role reversal here, because, you know, inside baseball, Mace Tyrell won last time.
Yeah, yeah. We had another week to think about this, and I'm sorry, this ace is going in the hole, yeah. If you know what I mean.
Oh no, he's stuck.
Oh no! Alright, Emilio.
Right, my final pitch.
Last chance.
Okay, last chance. Okay, so, our current winner is a guy who does what is expected of him, and no more. Mm-hmm. My argument for the most okayest dad is Ned Stark. Right. So the argument goes like this. If somebody asked me, what is the platonic ideal of a Westerosi father? I would actually point to Ned Stark in a couple of ways. Because firstly, Ned's interactions with his children are basically what's expected of a man in a patriarchal society like Westeros, right? He's not really engaged with raising his daughters, right? I remember that scene where he's like, war was easier than daughters. Like, really? Like, going to war is easier than having a daughter? Come on.
Okay, but was that actually Ned Stark, the character, or was that Benioff and Weiss, the human misogynists?
Well, right. But the thing is, people, if you watch clips on YouTube of that moment, there are lots of people like, yeah, Ned's speaking facts. I'm like, really? And I think the reason for that is just because men are not really expected to have that much of an active role in their daughter's lives. Like, Ned still thinks of Sansa as a child. He gets her a doll, even though that's not what, you know, she's, like, basically by the standards of her society, she's a woman, right? But on the other hand, if you think about how he raises his sons, he basically just does what's expected of them, right? Brandon is supposed to... is supposed to be the heir, so sorry, not Brandon, Rob. He's expected to be the heir, so he gets treated like the heir. You know, nobody expects that much about the youngest children, but it's like, you know, we'll raise him up. You know, it's like, hey, the expectation on my society is I've got to kill people with a sword who do crimes. You have to be here to watch that. You know, like, I'm going to bring my sons to this execution because that's what's expected of me in society. You know,
but that's also preparing them, because that's something they're going to have to be a part of.
Like, he's not handing them the sword. He's just, you know. But
also, they're young. He's saying to them, like, watch how I do this, because it's important, but you don't have to participate.
Yeah, but only Rob is actually expected to do this, because only Rob is expected to be the heir.
And what if Rob dies?
Well, then, you know, it'll be the situation.
What if Rob and Ned die at the same time, and then Bran has to be the new Lord of Winterfell, and he doesn't know how to do any of this stuff?
Then he wouldn't have been an especially active father, would he? Right?
But he did! He told Bran!
Well, he did. Well, that's just one thing. It's just like hey, you have to see this. Father says you're old enough to see it, so you have to see it. That's just the thing, okay, right? It's not.
You've now pulled the one thing card.
I think it's. I think that when I think about how Ned Stark raises his children, I think that he just does basically what's expected of him in his social class. I think the only thing that differentiates him slightly is because he's from the north. His children are a lot more insular from the rest of Westerosi society, Maybe his failings as a guy, right, his personal failings, his trauma, all of this whole situation about Lyanna, all of that stuff, makes him act in weird ways. But I do think as far as, like if I had to pick a standard dad, I feel like Ned Stark is the standard dad. The treatment that you're going to get from him, you're not going to be abused. He might be a little bit affectionate to you if he feels like, oh, he can relate to you, like, oh, you're strong, you know, Ned thinks of himself as a warrior, that kind of thing. But he's not going to make he's going to have like a little bit of, oh, Arya is into swords. Well, you know, I expect her to be a lady, but let's indulge her just a little bit, you know, that kind of deal. You know, Jon finds pups. That's a little bit dangerous, but let's, you know, he's not a combination of highs and lows. I think he's actually in the middle, right? As specifically just as a father, right? Not talking about anything else.
I'm going to give you my rating right from the beginning. I'm going to say nay.
Yes.
And the reason is, like, we've been looking at how the parents interact with their children a lot throughout this episode. Consider how much love Ned inspired in his children. Rob went to war for him. And yeah, that could be a case of, like, you know, Rob was raised on stories of the rebellion and stuff. Maybe he thinks that's what he has to do or whatever. But it's also genuinely motivated by love. Like, the people that Ned interacted with loved him and respected him and generally grew up to do correct, not necessarily smart things, but, like, morally correct things.
I think it's possible for you to have just been an okay... Like, I think it's possible for Ned to become this messianic figure, even though he wasn't actually that messianic, right? I think a large part of why Ned Stark inspires this loyalty is kind of just because of the mythology of the North, right? I don't actually think that Ned Stark lived up to the standards, you know, that might have sort of existed. Because, like, even Ned, right, was the second son. He wasn't never expected to sort of have the role that he did. It's like part of it, I think, is just Stark mythology, right? I think that a heavy part of what we're seeing here is just the mythology of the Starks. They are the house in the North.
Okay.
I don't necessarily think it's
mythology,
on
mythology. I think if we're talking about mythology, then I think it's Ned is in the unfavorable position of being next to a lot more interesting people.
Yeah, yeah.
And
sure.
I think that's the thing, is like people have this viewpoint of Ned that he's either like super boring, he's totally middle of the road, but he's kind of like John in that sense that he's like pretty much just a person, but because he's around these super interesting people, he seems a lot more boring by comparison. Because he's around these super terrible dads, he seems like a much better dad in comparison. But I don't think he ever reaches the realm of middling. I think he is a genuinely caring father that does try his best and just about goes above the middle of the road into good.
I hear that, right? I think that just in terms of expectations, right, I feel like Ned Stark is just, he's sort of the middle of the road, right? I don't think he's, you know, because the fact that he keeps a secret and that ultimately causes, and he, you know, he can't, you know, he can't give up his honor, ultimately causes so much misery for his children, right? If Ned Stark had just, you know, done something other than what he did.
Well, no. What caused the misery for his children was him lying and giving up his honor because he was promised that his children would be safe.
Yeah, but I think he could have... I think that was...
No, the Jon Snow secret didn't impact his kids at all.
Yeah, because he, you know, everything was sheltered. He didn't rock the boat too much, etc., etc. But
also, Jon went and lived with the criminal gang at the ice place. Like, he was barely a part of anyone's story after that.
Mm. All right. Well, I've laid my arguments. You can, the guy who sits in the Shark Tank chair can pass the judgment.
Well, no, let's hear from Hillary first.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, I would have to go nay too, just as, like, you know, Ned Stark's ultimate critic. I feel like, you know, if we're counting Theon as one of the kids that is under Ned's purview, the fact that, you know, he abducted Theon after a very serious traumatic event and never did anything to assuage Theon's fears to the point where he was like literally thought, oh, Ned Stark could kill me at any time. That's probably not good parenting.
Okay. Fair.
This is an awkward one. Does anyone want to kick Ned into the moon door?
Ned would honorably choose to just walk into the moon door. I think he understands the situation on Shark Tank.
That's fair. He does one of those, like, scuba fall off the back of the boat.
Yeah, yeah. You know, like, it's really amazing how different the results of this episode are from the first time.
There was a period of time when Ned Stark, in the initial fabled recording, Ned Stark was the top dad for a while, and then we got to Mace Tyrell. And we've just... The structure has fallen apart. But, you know, if you enjoy the structure of this video, please let us know. Stannis Baratheon won this time around. Congratulations to the one true king and the most mediocre man who has ever stepped into the realm of parenthood. But thank you so much for playing, you guys. This weird little brainchild I had.
Yeah, this is a very fun episode because I think that this is very different to the other kinds of lists that are on, you know, like who's the best fighter, you know, all of that kind of stuff. I feel like talking about okay dads is a very interesting way of looking at this piece of fiction because it is actually just a personal story. You know, Martin has always said that the only thing worth writing is the human heart in conflict with itself. If you strip out all of the battles and the magic and the prophecy, and it really is just the story about people not getting what they want and dealing with that, you know?
Mm. And thank you very much, Hillary, for just diving into this puddle of nonsense.
Caleb, let's be real. She legitimizes this entire...
Yeah, no, the only reason we're allowed to talk about Game of Thrones is because you're here.
Yeah, no, I'm always down to talk about Game of Thrones or A Song of Ice and Fire, and especially, you know, dragging the hell out of characters that I don't think get enough shade.
Well, thank you so much also to you. Yeah, you. Yeah, I'm looking... No, not him, you. For listening to this or watching it, depending on what medium you're using. If you like these kinds of lists, if you enjoy these kinds of rankings, then please let us know, because we have a bunch of ideas for this. I mean, Best Wine Aunt was thrown around last time, and I think that could be fun, because we made the observation that there's genuinely not very many mothers in this story.
Yes, true.
I wonder why. There's no implications about that statement at all.
The other thing is, we thought about doing, like, a best animal companion, like the dire wolves and dragons and stuff like that. We thought about, like, what's the coolest magic weapon or whatever. There's a ton of things that we could talk about if you guys want to hear about it, but the only way we're going to know how or what you want or whether to keep going with these is if you like and comment and subscribe and tell us. That's the only way. And thank you very much to the people who tell us that they like us the most, which is Liam Anderson, Dorianne, and Discordance, our $5 a month patrons. This video might be going up on there early, we don't know. But in the meantime, thank you so much for supporting us. Thank you to the amazing co-hosts we have with us. And do any of you want to just drop a quick Game of Thrones, House of the Dragon hot take?
No, I'm good.
Oh, jeez.
That's,
wait, no.
That's fair, you can say
no. I have to save all my hot takes for the video. No, I just, yeah, I wanted to say, fair, I've got to save all my hot takes for my naval history episode, which I feel like is going to get us a lot of hate.
I can't wait.
I don't think Martin is a good military writer. I don't think that's...
I mean,
yeah,
he
no, I would
out
agree
of
on
Vietnam.
That.
I genuinely think that the work is done a disservice by the fact that Martin just doesn't want to engage with the implications of the war fighting that he's talking about. You know, it is war politics kind of thing. But anyway, that's
okay.
That's
no, I think we just covered this. The war isn't the point, and I think he does, you know, explain the effects of the war pretty well. He doesn't like get into the nitty gritty of it. And, like, I get how that can be frustrating, but also, it's not the reason we're here.
No, that's true. I just think it would be better if he did.
Yeah, but it's like complaining about the buffet because the sprinkles are bad.
I mean... Okay, alright, anyway. Thank you, everybody, for watching this episode. All hail King Stannis the Manus. Yeah, Stannis
Baratheon.
No, I genuinely love that we're all Stannis supporters.
Yeah, we're Stans.
Stannis Stans? Yeah.
Yeah,
I love Stan. He's my favorite character. Thanks for watching, everyone. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.